as is told by somebody who developed affection for him, Sally Agarwal. A devotee is described, one of his qualities, he's a gentleman. So Prabhupada was very much displayed this quality in the apartment, living room, and so on, kitchen, the presence of the Agarwal and their guests. He was a very, very gentlemanly person. And so she remembers that if she couldn't take care of him, give him attention, that she had to clean the house, he would be self-sufficient, just chanting Hare Krishna. She said, I never had such a nice guest, an easy guest, who could take care of himself without my taking care of him. And Prabhupada cooked there on his three-tiered boiler, and they liked that very much. I remember some of the things, my favorites is, of course, Sally's expressions, how much she liked Prabhupada. And also, she said that they were Indian, or she wasn't, but the husband was, so they sent their child to Christian Sunday school, and the child then was learning the Bible, and when she saw Prabhupada one day, she started calling him Swami Jesus. And when she said that, Prabhupada said, and a little child shall lead them. It was like another quote from the Bible. In other words, she was the first one to recognize his stature. I'll read a stanza. In the first photo, you appeared confident, though you had no men or money. You stood with your open Bhagavatam. Your chatter was frayed, but you looked firm and charming and deep, quote, an inner stability that would be difficult to shake, observed Professor Larson. It would take all these qualities and more for venturing forth at a late age into Manhattan. 2 months sponsorship was all you had, so with half the time gone, you left for New York with a few coins and the name of a yogi you'd never met. Sally felt sick to see you go into the city without a friend. How was the stay in Butler helpful to Srila Prabhupada? What are some things he gained? Somebody say? Yes?
He saw that young people were attracted to the spiritual. In Butler, he says.
Butler. Yeah, not so much emphasis on young people. But you could. Okay, I'll ask somebody else. Yes? He became familiar with America. What kind of things?
Supermarkets,
vacuum cleaners, everything, the way things work. This is like a first place for him to see all these things. Vinod Vani?
No, I just mentioned Prabhupada's fascinated by all the American gadgets.
Yeah. What else did he learn? Yes?
People could understand his English.
Yeah? Like people could understand his English? Ambika? Yeah, he preached at some churches. I remember Prabhupada was telling us that in 26 Second Avenue in his room. I preached in churches at Butler. And the devotee asked, what kind of churches were they, Prabhupada? He thought, and he said, I don't know. he also saw that there was, was that in Butler? A little suspicion, too, about his preaching from the Christians. But people understood him. Another thing is, he said at one point later that when I came to America, I thought I might not be able to eat what you have here. I thought it would be all meat. I was prepared to eat just potatoes if that was all I could get. But he saw that the vegetarian diet was available in Butler. Well, these are some of the main things I remember. All right, yes?
One of the devotees, the Sankirtan devotee, she met with a girl grown up now at the airport. And she said, I remember Swamiji when my brother cut his tooth on Swamiji's shoes.
Huh.
He was teething on him.
Uh-huh.
And that's when he cut his tooth.
Yeah. And the mother was very upset that She said, those shoes have been all over India. You know how a mother would feel, her child is putting her mouth on the shoes. Well, we would say, well, the child was very fortunate. Into Manhattan. So, Prabhupada going into Manhattan is really dependence on Krishna. This is the meaning of sannyas. There's one kind of sannyas practice mentioned in the 7th canto of Bhagavatam called Ajagara Vritti, where a person lies down on the path like the python and just depends on whatever will come his way and doesn't make any efforts to take care of himself. So when a sage does that, he's just depending on Krishna, whatever Krishna sends. But Prabhupada in Manhattan, he took that even further as a higher example of renunciation. To not have money or any kind of support, guarantee by a movement behind him in India. And he wasn't interested so much in making that arrangement for support, but just in preaching and depending on Krishna. I recently heard Prabhupada in a lecture giving himself as an example, not of something extraordinary, but that this was an ordinary thing. He was trying to make the point that you don't have to struggle to maintain yourself. God maintains everyone, even the birds and so on. So he said, just like my year in New York, he said, I've been here now for over a year, and Krishna has taken care of me. I didn't have any money, but somehow or other, I have lived. So he wasn't saying it because I'm so surrendered, because I'm so pure. He gave it as an example that everybody should expect that Krishna will. But who can live? Who can be like that? Prabhupada and Dr. Mishra, you've already read about it. We like to remember Mishra's affection for Prabhupada. Although they were really at odds philosophically, Prabhupada said that I was kind to him and he was kind to me also. He when we interviewed Dr. Mishra, he said about Prabhupada, he knocked me down with love. And apparently he was very ill when they met. And Prabhupada's giving him prasadam regularly, saying, come on, take prasadam. So he said it saved my life. It was not bread he gave me, he gave me prasadam. But Dr. Mishra, he wouldn't let Prabhupada preach because he would always defeat Mishra's Mayavadi philosophy. Mishra had several places. So Prabhupada first went to his place on the west side of Manhattan, Riverside Drive, 12th floor or something, in an apartment. Mishra couldn't keep him there. Then he let Prabhupada stay in his yoga studio on 72nd Street. And then also he had a place in the country, very nice place, called Ananda Ashram, upstate New York. So Prabhupada visited all those places. But he hadn't come to just live somewhere. He had come to preach, and he wasn't able to. Does this have to be so up? Suddenly the volume... Oh. Prabhupada, this is an example of Prabhupada tolerating a situation, as preachers still will. And we go somewhere and you have to tolerate for the time being, living with somebody. And a preacher may even have to tolerate not being able to preach. Prabhupada was patient. You might think, I'm such a preacher, I cannot wait a minute. I cannot tolerate this situation. But he tolerated even that, not being able to preach freely. It's a meditation to think of Prabhupada in New York City at this time. He would go out sometimes to shop. He said sometimes he would get on a bus and just ride around the city looking at the city, thinking of places to preach and places perhaps to have a temple. And studying. Prabhupada studied human character and studied the situation. New York City is not a place to just... walk around casually. It's a very dangerous place. But Prabhupada wasn't afraid because he was transcendental. And also he said, I was a Calcutta man. So I've seen all these. If you've been in Calcutta, you see that what goes on there, a little chaos and everything. So he grew up there and he wasn't afraid of New York City. Now, he started thinking about getting a building in Manhattan, although he had just barely enough money to buy a few groceries to eat. So why did he want a building in Manhattan? What was his plan at such an early stage? Yes?
He wanted to bring the deities of Radha and Krishna to Jerusalem.
To bring deities of Radha and Krishna to New York. Right? What are some other reasons? Right. He wanted to lecture regularly, which would include the deities, having the deities in its place, just to give a lecture at the Tagore Society or at some church and then be gone, and the people have no chance to follow up, wasn't enough. It wasn't even enough to give them a book if they didn't have some place they could go to find out some more about it. So this is the idea, regular cultivation of people and giving them prasadam. They needed a place for that reason. Kirtans, seeing the deity, what we have now in the temples. In telling this story, I've told about seeing Prabhupada at this time externally and internally. So he tried to get help from India, and nobody would help him, neither his godbrothers nor rich men who he wrote to. So externally, it looked like he wasn't doing well. He therefore thought maybe I should go back. And this was his external situation, unrecognized, unappreciated, not able to preach. But then I described that internally he had success. So at this point, what was his success in an internal sense? Sarvabhauma? Yeah, he wasn't a failure. He was always... If the goal of a devotee is to always think of Krishna. So Prabhupada was successful. He was always doing something, chanting Hare Krishna, writing Srimad Bhagavatam. And although we say we couldn't preach, I meant he can't lecture to the students at Dr. Mishra's studio. But after a while he started even doing that. If not at the scheduled time of lecture, he started talking in his room. Therefore, it is better that we say that he was preaching somehow or other. He was distributing books in the bookstores. So these were his successes, to be always thinking of Krishna and to be engaged in trying to spread Krishna consciousness, regardless of the results. Because his spiritual master said, you can preach even if the four walls are the only thing listening to you. That is success, even though it would be factual to say that he wasn't getting much results at this time. He was successful. Yes, sorry. Yeah, Prabhupada was not compromising. Very good. Let's talk a little bit about the people who eventually did start coming to hear from him, bit by bit, in the yoga studio uptown. What kind of an audience did he have? He started to give some talks in his room. So what were the first persons like? Yes? Old ladies. Someone later, when some young people from downtown came, one of them described the uptown audience. He said, the Swami had a group of fuss-budgety old women who were coming to see him. They were perhaps going to see Dr. Mishra and then saw this other Swami there. And we can hear some of them on the lectures, especially there's one woman you hear some on some of these lectures from uptown. where she's very familiar with Prabhupada, not really listening so carefully. Remember, there's one point he was saying that when he was in India, he thought America would be something fantastic, completely different than anything in India. He said, but now I find that I come here, it's the same. He said, the people, you may be a little different, but everything is the same. And in the park, I see the same squirrels as in India. And she said, no, these squirrels are much bigger in America. So Prabhupada said, yes, that is admitted. They are very stout and strong. But she would always like, just take the example and get all hung up in the analogy rather than listen to the philosophy. He was telling about how the Mayavadis say that if you have any duality, it's like eye disease of seeing double. Prabhupada said, there is some eye disease, I think myopia. No, not myopia. And then she would go into what it... Myopia means nearsightedness. It actually is... whatever Prabhupada said. So there is some disease where seeing one thing, you see two. But that's about as far as she would go just to understand what the eye disease was. And it's kind of amusing, but it's also impressive to hear how Prabhupada... And he didn't leave her behind. He stayed with her and talked with her, but tried to preach also. And there's one male voice. Prabhupada is lecturing, and then he says, "What are you reading?" The man says, "I'm reading the Bhagavad Gita." Right while the lecture is going on. Of course, Prabhupada didn't have a Bhagavad Gita published. Prabhupada said, "No, you listen to me." "I am listening," the man said, listening and reading the Bhagavad Gita, same thing. Prabhupada said, "No, don't turn your attention, just hear." So they weren't very submissive. But it was something, and Prabhupada was pleased, and he kept trying to preach to them. He made some tapes of kirtans, he made tapes of, played them for people. And in these lectures, there is, I think, a difference. These lectures and other early New York City lectures from later, there's a kind of urgency in Prabhupada's voice, where even his voice breaks, squeaks sometimes, and it's so all I can think of is urgent or earnest in trying to get across his points to the people, so that, and he's speaking, as Swarga said, without any compromise, trying to tell the people that they should surrender to a spiritual master and accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they don't know who Krishna is at all or what a spiritual master is, anything. But he was preaching so strongly for them to surrender. So this is certainly something to worship and to try to apply. We're all preaching. At different times we talk to people and we're lecturing. But this quality of really wanting to convince somebody, wanting people to take to Krishna consciousness, it can't be matched. But it's every preacher has to have it, as his spiritual master said, a preacher has to have life. So this is the essence of the life, to have the knowledge and really want that person to take to Krishna consciousness. Often we balance this by saying how we have to be detached, don't be too heavy, and don't expect that the person will become a devotee necessarily. But the other side of it is to desire very strongly, almost like a lust, that I try to convince these people to surrender to Krishna and desire it very much. You can hear it even in Prabhupada's voice. There are many little anecdotes of people that Prabhupada met in the biography, and even outside of the biography, we gathered all we knew, but still, people in New York, devotees who preach in New York City, they continually meet people who knew Prabhupada, someone just said about in Butler. So anyway, from any place you know, or especially the biography, what are some personal exchanges Prabhupada had in the first year, and some of the impressions people had of Prabhupada? You can start gathering some of them quickly. Yes?
Just remember that Robert Nelson, his description of the little room that Prabhupada had, he said it was very narrow, like, railway car. He's going to be very disappointed as to
Yeah. Yeah, that gives us a picture of how Prabhupada was living and how he befriended a person like Mr. Nelson. What did she say? That this first boy who met him described Prabhupada's room. He said it was narrow like a railway car, like a railroad car. That I'd be disappointed to see it. Sankarshan. Yeah. Mr. Rubin, the subway conductor. He was from Turkey. But living in New York City. He met Prabhupada. He said he was like a lone prophet, like Isaiah. And I would see him sitting and walking around, so I started talking with him. He said that I have temples and I have devotees, but you don't see them now. They will come in the future. And Mrs. Ferber, in the Paragon bookstore, Prabhupada went in once. She said, I don't want the books. Then he went back again and said, why don't you consider take the books? All right, she took some books. He seemed to have, he placed the books on consignment, that they wouldn't give him any money, but if they sold them, then he would. She would call her up sometimes on the phone, have you sold any books? And they started selling. He would go down, collect the money, and give her more books. And she said, when he would come, he would ask for water, may I have a cup of water? She said that they had a water cooler there. She would always tell people, yeah, it's over there. But for him, somehow he was older, and she just felt inclined that she would go and get the water for him. And every time he asked, she would get the water. And he bought her samosas one time. There are many people like that. Better move along. Yes?
Is that place you met first Hayagriva?
That's tomorrow. I'm going to that. But you're leading into it. That uptown, the young people found out that there's some really fantastic Swami uptown. A group of people in a macrobiotic restaurant in Lower East Side. One of them went, and then another one went, and they started finding out about it. One of the older ladies there, we interviewed her, and I said, we heard that later the different kind of audience started coming, and she said, yes, the Swami started attracting some people. Either they lived on the Bowery or in attics, and they used to come with funny hats and with blankets wrapped around them, and they startled me. So, in addition to the people who were there, these younger people started coming to see Prabhupada there. And again, Prabhupada is so surrendered, even the wild youth. He saw some spark in them and he was interested. And then his room was robbed. He suspected it was by the superintendent of the building, who probably broke the... It was broken anyway. The glass transom over the door was broken. His typewriter was taken, and a tape recorder, whatever he had. And he suspected the superintendent. And at that time, he was invited by Harvey Cohen, a man who was coming to see him, to live... to shift, to be a co-mate, a co-tenant in a loft in the Bowery. And so he moved. You really have to fully appreciate Prabhupada's move to the Bowery, you'd have to have seen the Bowery in New York City, how degraded it is, but we've described it in some detail. It was when Prabhupada was going to move, there was a man, he had an acquaintance, an electrician uptown, and the man was shocked because actually Prabhupada had been in rather fashionable or decent places, Riverside Drive, 72nd Street, and he was in Butler, and now suddenly he's going to the dregs, the lower depths, the Bowery, where thousands of alcoholics live on the streets without any place. Just at night they were given some place to sleep, where the death rate and crime rate is 5 times higher than anywhere else in Manhattan. And Prabhupada is going there to live. So he told the electrician, said, don't go there. It's a horrible place. You should not. Very dangerous. And Prabhupada said, I did not know what is danger. I saw every place as Krishna's place. This is like Narayana Paraksarve Nakatashana Vibhyate. Because he's devoted to Krishna, he's not afraid of anything. So, it's very striking for Prabhupada to go to that place. And I've mentioned two features that seem to be very wonderful. One is that a person of Prabhupada's stature, so pure, so scholarly, and so on, could tolerate it there. Another is that he was very lenient with the people who came to see him there, accepting them as they were and trying to engage them in Krishna consciousness. What was the audience like that that came to him on the Bowery? Jason. Yeah, it wasn't that the alcoholics came, the old derelicts and so on, but also in the Bowery there were artists and musicians living in lofts, and word got around about him, and somehow the way these things happen. Certain groups at a certain time are attracted. Like in America now, there's this straight edge group, very particular group is attracted to Krishna consciousness. So a very particular group of sophisticated, hip, many of them musicians and artists and their girlfriends came to Sri Prabhupada, somewhat different than what happened at 26 Second Avenue. One of them was named Carl Jurgens, and he just says it was a very interracial, music-oriented scene, meaning the scene at Prabhupada's loft. And another girl, Carol, said, whenever he had the chanting, the people were fairly in awe. It was the people who went there, that it was the music or the chanting that particularly attracted them. They weren't so much looking to become disciples. Very few of them did become disciples. But they liked to go there in the morning or other times, and it was a very mystical, attractive thing to chant with him. We get a little glimpse that... you can hear him talking to them also. In those lectures, I find that there are several themes that Prabhupada preached to this group who were coming to see him in the Bowery, and maybe you can pick it up in the biography. What were some of the themes that he was preaching to the people in the Bowery? Yes. No. I agree with that. That comes a little later.
Yoga systems?
Yoga systems? Maybe. But not so prominent. Yes.
I remember on one take here in Prospect, it's so encouraging that whatever little bit you do, even if you go away, it will never be lost.
Yeah. And he expressed that as dovetailing the consciousness with the Supreme Consciousness. This word has come down to us in Krishna consciousness, but it was used repeatedly there and strongly, and this is part of his leniency. To them he meant, whatever you are, you don't have to change what you're doing. And he specifically says, if you're a musician, if you're an artist, you can continue to do that, but do it for Krishna. And so he emphasized Krishna consciousness is very easy. You don't have to change anything. Now you're doing it for your own pleasure, for sense gratification. Do it for the Supreme Consciousness, Krishna, and this will be your liberation. So this attractive, easy activity. And one particular thing that he would talk about is prasadam, that you're cooking now you can cook for Krishna. He said, the other day we cooked some prasadam and you all came, and wasn't it nice? Was there any difficulty? What is the difficulty? Everyone enjoyed the prasadam that we distributed to our friends. So it is no difficulty at all. You just do it for Krishna. So that kind of accessibility of Krishna consciousness, which is just what they needed. They weren't about to hear that first you have to do this, and then do this, and follow this rule, and do this, and this, and then maybe you can practice Krishna consciousness. But just do it for Krishna. Dovetailing the individual consciousness with the Supreme. There was one very serious person there, Michael Grant, who later became Mukunda Goswami. And his observation of Prabhupada there, he was struck by the, as he says, the utter poverty of Prabhupada's living situation and the fact that he was speaking about God. He had seen different swamis and persons like that, and usually to speak about God was very daring. They'd speak about something impersonal and so on. Only like an old-fashioned minister would speak about God. But he was Prabhupada speaking about God in a way that was interesting and educated. But that was very startling to him. So theistic about it. And also the poverty that he was in. So this combination, seeing that this is an educated, very spiritual person, but he's put himself in the Bowery. So his final observation was he must have something very important to say if he is willing to put himself in such a condition. One of my favorite anecdotes from the Bowery period is the impressions of Michael Smith, the reporter from the Village Voice. It sounds like Prabhupada invited them because he's in the course of the interview, he said to the reporter that he had heard that your newspaper will be good for, will reach the kind of people that I am trying to get. So Prabhupada may have heard about him. Anyway, he tells that he went there because a friend told him there's a Swami on the Lower East Side, I think he's about to start a major world religion. So he said he went there and said it was a funky loft with a lot of old, worn-out rugs around in this big area. And when I walked in, I saw all these different people dressed in hippie garb, or maybe what they thought was Indian dress. But they weren't doing anything together. One was sitting in one place, another was sitting in another place on the floor, and all in some kind of self-styled prayer or meditation, whatever it was. It was very strange. Nobody looked up to say anything to me. So he said, I didn't know whether I should take my shoes off. I walked behind a curtain, and then I saw Swami Bhaktivedanta. He was sitting cross-legged. And I asked him, do I have to take my shoes off? He said, no, sit down. And he said what he liked was that, oh, then he said to Prabhupada, what are those people doing out there? And Prabhupada said, I don't know. They don't know either. So this gives us a real picture that the people they would attend a lecture and just hang out in the loft, and Prabhupada, he couldn't teach them. They were so unsubmissive and strange, maybe on drugs. And they would be sitting in this loft doing their meditations, and Prabhupada would just be on the other side of the curtain. He said, I don't know what they're doing. They don't either. And I try to teach them, but they misunderstand me, he said. Michael Smith says, his head didn't seem in the clouds. He wasn't talking mysticism every third word. I guess that is where his soul was at, but it isn't where his normal conversational consciousness was at. It was obvious to me I was not talking to some fellow who had just decided that he had seen God and was going to tell people about it. He was an educated man, more than myself. I just plain liked the guy. So he liked Prabhupada. Another exchange Prabhupada had was with a disciple of his godbrother. The godbrother is Madhav Maharaj. The disciple, now it can be known, is actually Mangal Maharaj. So at that time he was Brahmachari, and he wanted to come and join Prabhupada. So he wrote, and Prabhupada said, yes, come on. And he said, I must write to my guru, or see my guru. Prabhupada said, what's the problem? I'm serving Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur. It's one mission. There'll be no objection. But then his guru dissuaded him from going, and made an allusion that Prabhupada's attempt to gain money from Mr. Singhania and these other things, it sounds rather strange, or we would say flaky, that what he's doing there. And so Mangal Brahmachari wrote to Prabhupada, "If your program is not bona fide, the approach to a big personality will be a ludicrous one, no doubt." In that way, he showed that he couldn't, his guru didn't like the idea and didn't want him to go. And that was just one person, but everything else failed. The Bank of India wouldn't give sanction clearance. Mr. Singhania decided he didn't want to do it. None of the Gaur brothers wanted to do it. So Prabhupada wrote to this Mangal Brahmachari, kind of summing up what had been happening. And he said, "The controversy is now closed. There's no need of help from anyone else. We are not always successful in our attempts at preaching work, but such failures are certainly not ludicrous. In the absolute field, both success and failure are glorious. Even Lord Nityananda pretended to be a failure at converting Jaghai and Madhai in his first attempt. He was personally injured, but it was not ludicrous. It is transcendental and glorious for all parties concerned." Therefore, you see how Prabhupada was so determined. If nobody's going to help me, that's all right. And they even said, the government of India said to him, "Why don't you try to get money there in America? We can't help you. We can't convert any money. If you want to do something, try to get money from the Americans." And it was like a brush off, a rejection. But Prabhupada thought, yes, all right, then it's finished. I'm not going to get help from anyone. If I can stay here at all, it has to be from these people. And therefore, more than ever, his focus just changed or evolved to just trying to start a movement with the American people. And that he would do when he moved to his next location from the Bowery. So any questions or discussion about this? You're in New York. We have a little time. Why did Prabhupada move from the Bowery? When I say we'll talk about the next place he went to, but if things seem to be going kind of interesting there with the musicians and everything, why did he leave? Yes?
We have this problem with this guy that was living with Inga, went crazy on drugs, and his papa didn't have to stay there anymore and moved to New York.
Yeah. This was the situation. How precarious and dangerous it was for him. He was forced to move. And immediately he moved out. He didn't go back. And he had no place to leave. It was a real emergency. And Mukunda tells us, Mukunda Maharaj, how he moved immediately to Carl Jürgen's apartment. But Carl Jürgen's girlfriend didn't like Prabhupada. And Prabhupada knew he had to get out of there. So he asked him, "You must find me some place. I cannot stay here." Arabam.
I think I read some letter that Prabhupada wrote a little later to Sally Agarwal, and he was trying to encourage her to start a restaurant.
Yeah.
Did she move to New York later? Or?
No, she didn't. That was earlier when he was uptown.
Oh.
Yeah, right. For her to give up her suburban home and everything and come to New York City and open a restaurant, it would take a completely surrendered disciple. And even nowadays, he could hardly find a disciple who would be willing to do that. But he offered them these opportunities. Yes?
And you say also that it was Krishna's desire that Srila Prabhupada wanted to bully because it's a place where what kind of people can hear Srila Prabhupada. If Prabhupada was somewhere else, maybe people
will
not
reduce. Yeah.
So it was Krishna's desire.
Yeah, that we were talking about that the last class, how we asked, why did it take so long for Prabhupada to leave India? And we figured how everything was meant by Krishna, that he should come at this time. And then once he came to New York, that also was Krishna's will, that he should go to the place where it would take off the Krishna consciousness movement. Yes?
How come only one person could have stayed?
Oh, you mean, who was that one person? Oh, why out of the Bowery only one? I'll talk about that tomorrow, about the changing groups from the Bowery people to the other people, and why, and what was the difference, and why they didn't become disciples, as far as I can understand. All right, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Yesterday, we discussed Srila Prabhupada's struggle alone in New York City, 1965. He stayed over the winter of 65-66. It was very difficult. He'd never even seen snow before. One morning he woke up, looked out the building, and he thought the building next door had all been whitewashed. And then he realized, oh, that's snow. Still he wore just, he had a coat, but he wore his dhoti and his white pointy rubber shoes walking through heavy snowfall. Not listening to the advice of some of the Mayavadi sannyasis in New York from the Ramakrishna Mission, who advised Prabhupada that if you're going to preach in the West, you should dress like the Westerners, and the vegetarian diet is not advisable either. And they also smoke cigarettes, Swami Nikalananda and others. But Prabhupada didn't compromise in any of those ways. So we described how he went to the Bowery and then why he had to leave the Bowery. There's a map of Manhattan in your book, and you can see the places. So just a little bit north of the Bowery is this street running east and west, which is pronounced Houston Street. And then above that starts the Lower East Side. And so that's where Prabhupada went when Michael Grant found him this place at 26 Second Avenue. They'll have a stanza describing Prabhupada moving there. Second Avenue, with traffic pouring noisily past the front, seemed not an ideal tirtha. But the souls were falling off from here, and so it was a good place to catch them. He walked out in his new neighborhood and saw the gas station people and the tombstone people, and they saw him. The Empire State Building was plainly in view, like a huge hypodermic needle, standing falsely proud, and the plane of the avenue was sprawling uptown into congestion and sordid lives. Prabhupada was used to New York and ready for a step forward, as fresh and eager as a young boy. I was living in the Lower East Side. I had been living there 2 years before Prabhupada came there. And I was trying to think of how to describe it without getting into details and to his an audience, a purified audience. So one image I thought of, or expression, is that it was like the way we think of Vrindavan. Many young people thought of Lower East Side like that, as like the most mystical spiritual place you could go and live. Of course, it's a perverted reflection of Vrindavan. But the idea that by going there, I can get away from the mundane world. There's also something there that's not exactly perceivable by the eyes. But if you go there and live the life, as understood by a small group who understand the new consciousness that's taking place, there, you can experience what cannot be experienced anywhere else. And so I think this has been described sociologically in the planting the seed. And I described it personally in a memoir with Prabhupada in the early days. This Leela of Prabhupada in 22nd Avenue is my favorite time of Prabhupada. So we can acknowledge that we may all be attracted to favorite pastimes of Prabhupada when we hear about them or from our experience of them. Earlier, when we were discussing about Prabhupada at Radha Damodar Temple, I mentioned how Mahanidhi Swami has written a book about Prabhupada in the Radha Damodar Temple, and he has advocated that this is the most important leela. But it's also from this kind of favoritism that is natural that we have. So, addressing that Radha Damodar Temple's importance, some of the points Maharaj made was that Prabhupada was in an internal meditation of Radha Krishna's pastimes in the area of Seva Kunj. Therefore, it's most important. But in citing our favoritism for these 66 pastimes in New York City, we can say that although it was important, Prabhupada left that place. So if you leave some place and go somewhere else, it indicates you think something else is more important. He left Vrindavan, and not just whimsically or out of some mistake, but on the order of Rupa Goswami and Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur. Although Rupa Goswami is so much in the heart of Vrindavan, he also wanted Prabhupada to take Vrindavan and teach Vrindavan starting in New York City. So New York City Leela of Prabhupada is no less intense or less spiritual than Vrindavan. There's differences. The mood that is prominent in New York City in Prabhupada is a mood of compassion. Otherwise, why is he there? Somebody, when Prabhupada was in Bombay, ready to go on the boat, living in the colony of the Scindia Company, he said some person joked with him and said, "Oh, I know why you want to go to America. You want to enjoy there, Swamiji." Prabhupada said, "What? I can enjoy it. My life is finished." So Prabhupada was not going to New York City for any enjoyment. Rather, it was very difficult. But out of compassion, to give people Krishna consciousness, out of love for the order of the spiritual master and Krishna. And while he was there, he remembered Vrindavan in separation. And in one talk he says, "Here I am now sitting in New York, the world's greatest city. But my heart is always hankering after that Vrindavan. I am not happy here. I shall be very happy to return to my Vrindavan, that sacred place." "Then why are you here?" "Because it is my duty. I have brought some message for you people on the order of my spiritual master. If I go and sit down in Vrindavan, that will be very good for my personal convenience. I shall be very comfortable there and shall have no anxiety. But I have taken all risks in this old age because I am duty bound." At 22nd Avenue, Prabhupada formed ISKCON. Actually, Michael Grant, Mukunda, he saw a sign on the Bowery in Prabhupada's place, ISKCON. But it wasn't actually formed legally. So this name of this society, Prabhupada thought of it at the time. He had discussed it with some friends, and someone suggested that your society should have a different name. Does anyone remember what was the proposed alternative? Yes, sorry. Yeah, International Society for God Consciousness, more broad-minded. But Prabhupada said, "No, if I say only God, then they'll bring in so many ideas of this is God, that's God. Leaves it too vague. What is God?" So we will prove that Krishna is God. And this phrase, Krishna consciousness, was his expression. And that also came from, Prabhupada says it came from a Vaishnava, a Vedic source. Does anyone know the source of the phrase Krishna consciousness? Yes? From Rupa Goswami. Yeah, and it appears in Padyavali. The phrase is Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavita, to be absorbed in the mellow taste of executing devotional service to Krishna. Consciousness was a very popular word in the 1960s, so it was a very fit word, and still is. Consciousness, Krishna consciousness. To think of Krishna, to be absorbed in the mellow of Krishna. I'll be talking about some memories of those days today, but I wanted to first establish some of the ingredients. And of course, this, I'm assuming you've already read the material, so we're going over, we're churning nectar that has already been tasted by you to make it more nectarian. Some of the special ingredients of Prabhupada in those days. One is his accessibility. Later, Prabhupada was quite protected and insulated. No one could get to see him, none of his disciples, unless he had some very special business to get through all the secretaries. So he was very accessible in those early days. I'll be drawing a map or chart of the storefront. But he also had an apartment. And so he would stay in his room. And almost any time you wanted to go and see him, you could go and see him in his room. We would even, because none of the devotees knew the philosophy very well, if somebody came in the storefront and was inquiring, they'd say, well, why don't you go up and see the Swami? So not only disciples, but anyone who wanted to talk with him could go and talk with him. So that's a special ingredient. Another was, as comes out in all the reminiscences, that the devotees were like spiritual babies. That's why the stories are humorous. And Prabhupada said that this is a kindergarten of spiritual life that we're conducting here. So this is a nice, this is a special feature, and it's also good to keep this in mind today, even 25, 26 years later. Some of the devotees who may have been there, or whether they're there or not, Prabhupada's followers, many of them now have responsible posts. They're considered experienced devotees, even their initiating disciples. So to remember that we are still spiritual babies, to remember that babyhood is not a bad thing, because one should always remain as a fool before the spiritual master and feeling like that, that I need him, I'm dependent on him. In those, at that place, in that time, Prabhupada very quickly gave us essentials of spiritual life that can never be taken away. There are so many upheavals in the material world, and even in a religious movement like ISKCON, where things seem to change completely, policies and ways of worship, and so many things may change. Authorities may change. So it can get confusing. But he gave us essentials that we know can never be taken away from us as our Guru Seva. And that is to chant Hare Krishna, and to distribute prasadam, to take prasadam, and to preach Krishna consciousness. He gave those things at that time. Japa. And another special feature is that Prabhupada had gave emphasis to kirtan. So I'm going to play a sample of the kirtan. But first, describe a little the setting in which it was conducted. Three nights a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, there would be full kirtan, And then every morning there was a quieter kirtan. You even hear Prabhupada on some tapes saying, softly, softly, if it gets too loud, because the neighbors would complain. And even the man above would pour water through this ceiling. They got up a petition once too. I recently heard Prabhupada lecturing in the 1970s, and he was talking about this. He said, it wasn't even early in the morning, it was 7 o'clock. And we would chant, he said, and then so many tenants, they would come half naked. And he meant they just got up from bed. And they would come to me complaining, what is this? We are trying to sleep, he said. And Mr. Chudy, that was the name of the landlord, was also the janitor. Mr. Chudy would come and say, stop. And he said that, or we will, and sometimes Prabhupada said they would bring the police. He said, but we did not stop. We tried to do it softly though. But in the evening, it was allowable to have a big kirtan. And many people would come just for that kirtan and take part with their instruments. And that was allowed and encouraged. There was noise from outside. It's almost like it was an inner kirtan, but it was also like an outer kirtan because so many guests came, and the street was right there too, Second Avenue, the traffic going by, distracting. But the kirtan allowed the devotees to concentrate in the midst of so many distractions from people on the street who were looking in and making comments and everything. Here in this, the image I have of like Krishna Balaram Mandir is like a fort. It has walls and there's chokidars and everything. Although the world outside is not so alien either. But in there is like very fragile existence. And what was outside was alien. People weren't so friendly. And there was just this like flimsy door breakable window, big window, and the whole world out there. And Prabhupada with this very rare consciousness inside the storefront. But he was so strong that we were able to maintain it. I have two tapes we'll just play for a few minutes. The first one, these are, in case you want to get them, this is called V3, Vintage 3, Hare Krishna Kirtan. And this first one is without a drum. So it's very early kirtan. Very early Prabhupada, he wouldn't sit on any kind of elevated seat. He had a straw mat, and there were some straw mats for guests to sit on. And he would pass out cartels and then teach how to play the rhythm. On this tape, you can even see here and say, 1, 2, 3, so then people start. So this is a special, very early flavor, not so melodic, but very sweet in its own way. Okay, you can play it. Hear the response of kirtan, but I've cued the next one in the middle of the kirtan, and this is with a drum. It was a bongo drum that Prabhupada had, one head. He played like that, but he played like a madrunga beats. And here you hear a nice chorus of devotees. Prabhupada taped these things himself, or he would sometimes have an assistant do it, but he was in charge of the taping. And it was right in view. Those are the old-fashioned days of reel-to-reel tapes. We didn't even have cassettes. But he had a pretty good machine. Someone had given him another one, although one was stolen. And so you would see, while Prabhupada was lecturing, you'd see the tape going, reel-to-reel tape. And now fortunately we have about 40 or more lectures from 1966. And by listening to those lectures, you can really enter the mood of those days. The way he was preaching and different asides and remarks that he says and the noise at the door and the dogs barking and everything. It's quite a bit comes across. We mentioned yesterday about the urgency in his voice. Try to convince the people to take to Krishna consciousness. And even more so now, in his own place, preaching with his society, ISKCON, he was emphasizing the missionary spirit. So this was remarkable, that he would be asking people who were just coming to Krishna consciousness to become preachers. And I have an excerpt from one lecture, 30-766. Where he's telling everyone to become spiritual masters. He says, you can become a Brahmin. You can become a great devotee of Lord Krishna. You can become the spiritual master of the world. I think you should take it seriously. I am an old man. I may go. Some of you at least understand this science and take up this science and become the future hope of this country or the world. That is my request to you. You should take this chance and become a spiritual master for all the people. Thank you very much. And then Prabhupada personally took the kirtan outdoors to the parks. And although he went once to Tompkins Square Park, he went regularly to the park that was in his own neighborhood, Tompkins Square Park. Did I say Washington Square Park? No. Although he went once to Washington Square Park, that was just the first time, he went regularly to his local park, Tompkins Square Park, which was very much in the mood of the whole Lower East Side, new frontier, drug-expanding consciousness, and so on. Prabhupada often spoke about that in later years, and that sets the example for all Harinam outdoors to bring it to people who don't know anything about Krishna consciousness, even without introducing them to philosophy, to just chant, and they become attracted and they come around and they sing. So Prabhupada had great faith and the potency of the holy name, and this is an important part of his movement that he personally introduced. Those are very historic occasions, very bold to give it to Western people in that way. I have a stanza about that. What you did that afternoon was only a start, yet whatever great things devotees may do today is inspired by your chanting in Tompkins Square Park. Your act of redemption lives on. The singing continues because of you. As you stood before the oak tree and spoke to the common people on public ground, hippies found it mellow. Local poets and musicians celebrated for the moment, and hoodlums were held at bay, and a few were struck with the serious thought to surrender. What were some of the responses to the people in the tenement buildings and on the stoops and on the streets as Prabhupada went to Tompkins Square Park to do his chanting? Yes? Yelling things out at him. You forgot your pajamas. Hey, Arab. Hey, Arab. Things that we hear still today, but being directed at Prabhupada. And although today we still may be thin-skinned, but we're used to it. And more important, we have an identity that I'm a devotee, and this is my austerity to take this. But in the beginning, Prabhupada was the only one who looked like a devotee, and it was quite an austerity to have to hear people yelling at you for something that you just begin to identify with. So we all kind of just took shelter of him, the only devotee. Someone else? Yeah. Didn't even know what it was, yeah. Now, and Prabhupada was not affected by this kind of hooting. Now, fortunately, after many years of not having that property, ISKCON has recovered to 26 Second Avenue, and it's become a preaching center and a shrine. So devotees can go when they visit New York City. They used to go anyway and just look in the window, but now it's actually a preaching center. And I went there last year, and it was a very thrilling occasion for me to lecture there and to remember the different things and where they took place in the room. So I wanted to make a chart. I'll just make it like a rectangle because I can't remember all the contours. So here there was a big pane, a big window pane, and it was broken one time when kids used to make a lot of noise, and once they threw firecrackers in, so Ramananda, the biggest devotee, he went out and he followed the kids who did it down the block, and they came up behind him and grabbed him by the neck and squeezed him real hard in the neck. They were like young kids. But then that night, the window was smashed in retaliation. Prabhupada was away at the time, but he came soon after and the window was broken. This was after he had left. But one of the devotees said, "Prabhupada, was that Maya that broke the window from the outside?" Prabhupada said, "Maya is outside the window and inside the window. Wherever you don't chant Hare Krishna, Maya is there." There was a seat there, there still is, like a wooden seat you can sit on. And here is where the picture was, done by Harvey Cohn, Aridat, of the Panchatattva, which
look very strange. These men with long hair and just goatees on, all dancing like this. And a little piece of paper that said, Bhagavad Gita classes. And here was the door. Prabhupada kept the door open. And all kinds of people would look in and sometimes shout in and so on. You would leave your shoes here. And here for a while is where it was kept the innards of an upright piano that someone found it on Second Avenue, and somebody put it out in their trash. Big piano with all the wires exposed. So it was left there, and during the kirtan, somebody would run their hand across. That was the wild spirit that Prabhupada allowed. So, in the beginning, this of course changed over the months and years. But in the beginning, there was nothing really there, no altars or tables, and people just sat on the floor. And Prabhupada was up here. So this is the courtyard of the apartment. And then there was a second building behind it, which is where he had his apartment. Here's a little bathroom with a toilet in it. There's even one lecture you hear, Prabhupada's lecturing, and he says, "Excuse me, I have a call of nature." And you get up and just go in there and you come out again. And there's a little sink attached here. And here's a side door. So, typical evening, people would come and gather, like, and sit down and wait for Prabhupada to come. No one would begin without him, because he was the only one who had the potency to conduct the kirtan. So then, it would be like a grand entrance, and he would come from his room and come in this door. And he looked so beautiful in New York City. Such an unusual sight, with his saffron and his golden skin and his fresh tilak mark that he just put on upstairs, and his white pointy shoes. And he would step out, he would look at the audience, and usually he would smile, a big smile at everything going on, at everybody there, glad to see that they were there. And he'd step out of his shoes and walk after a few months to his dais had been built for him to sit on. So this is where he conducted the kirtan. I used to like to sit over here. I remember different things that happened in different places of the room. There was one musician who recorded. He was a combination of a jazz and classical musician. His name was Burton Green. And he came a few times and came to lunch too. I remember one night he was sitting over here. Prabhupada was lecturing, everyone was attentive, and all of a sudden he got up. And he was like looking around, he was restless, and he started like looking for another place to sit. He didn't like where he was sitting. So Swamiji looked at him and said, "What is the matter?" He said, "I feel boxed in over here." Who knows what was going on in his mind. So Prabhupada laughed and said, "You are a box within a box." He explained that your soul, you have a soul in the body that's already boxing you. Now you're feeling boxed in. And then when the kirtan would start, after a while, it took some time to understand that Prabhupada liked devotees to dance. So people would get up and dance, which meant mostly just shifting one foot to the other and holding your hands up. But then we started another kind of dancing, which was to come right in front of the Swami, who would be sitting looking out at the audience. He would look out, or sometimes he would keep his eyes closed and then just look around everyone and close his eyes again. And just with movements of his head, you could understand he was feeling ecstasy and keeping everything in control. So we would come, the dancing would come near him, and it would go around in a circle. Like this, devotees like in a file, and they would, so you'd be out here, and then you'd come close, real close to him, and you'd look at him and see his hands playing the drum and his eyes closed, and then you'd go out again, and go round and round like that.
That was the kirtan.
While other people maybe would be standing, but most people sitting, chanting. And when the chanting would be over, he would chant for a full half hour in the beginning, and the full half hour at the end. When the chanting was over, then big exodus out the door, or many people would go. So they just come for the chanting. It was quite rude that they would do it. And then what people would be left, Prabhupada would say, come forward, try to move the audience down, then he would speak. And then at the end of the whole program, after the second kirtan, then he would distribute an apple. That was the prasadam. And we had a bowl, like an artificial wooden bowl, and an apple, and a knife. He'd be given those things, and he would cut the apple again and again into half, into fourths, into eighths, to sixteenths. He had many little pieces. And then he would take, he would pop one in his mouth and ask that it be distributed. And it was a very wonderful moment, because everyone was tired and sweating in the summer, and feeling blissful, feeling that we've been on a real trip by chanting with him. Psychedelic trip without drugs. And sometimes when Prabhupada would be chewing his apple, he would come, the pits would come in his mouth. So he turns while he was sitting and he would spit the pits into the sink. So we were at a stage that everything he did was amazing. And it was amazing. And the one devotee, Rupa Nuga, said when he saw that, he thought, nobody else could do that. even to accurately being able to spit them into the sink. Those are little things. But the big thing was this, what he was doing to our hearts and to our lives, changing us into, Still Sanjuta was to write later, from drug-addicted hippies into servants of Krishna and humanity. One might say that the emphasis on this period is that merely nostalgia, that it's not a substantial thing to do. But, and I raised that question in one stanza and briefly answered it. Prabhupada, if in those days you were externally so meagerly equipped and the Krishna consciousness movement had barely begun, then why do we recall it as so important? Is this merely nostalgia? No, it is not mere nostalgia. Is remembrance of Krishna material sentiment? No. Lord Krishna himself declares, the pure devotee's life is as good as the eternal pastimes of Krishna. And one evidence of this, that it is important, it is dear, is that Prabhupada himself liked to recall, and he said those were happy days. For example, when Prabhupada returned in a very triumphant mood 10 years later, 1976, he had achieved so much in New York City. He had a skyscraper building there and the first big Rath Yatra down Fifth Avenue. But when he arrived in the city and was driven by Jayananda in a car to the Brooklyn Temple, as he went through the city, he immediately began reminiscing. The Brooklyn Bridge he saw. And he started remembering, I used to walk here, I used to go there. And he said, in New York, I feel a little at home because first I came here. I was loitering on the street here and there. From 1965 September to July 1967, continually I stayed in New York.
Generally, the Swamis, when they think of leaving India, they think of going to London. But I thought, no, I shall go to New York. Sometimes I was even dreaming that I had gone to New York. So Prabhupada was able to even recall the bookstores that he had sold books to, and all the places where he had shopped, and the grocery, and so on. He liked to remember New York as happy days, because he was depending on Krishna only. Another time, I remember that he remembered, was even at the end of his life, in the last months, when he was staying here in Vrindavan. One night, when he was very weak, he used to go on the roof of his building to get some cool air in August, May. This was in August when I'm recalling. And so devotees were fanning him. He was sitting in his bed. And then he began again, 1966 memories, just like we're doing. One after another would come. And he would say that at first I was cooking just for myself. Then Kirtananda began to cook for me and a few people. Then a dozen people used to come. And that boy, Stradhish, would come. And he would eat so much. I would give him four chapatis and say, Stradhish, you want more? Yes. And he would take another four. Then, Stradhish, more? Yes. Another four. And at 20, I would stop. No more. These were like, in Prabhupada's heart, they would come out. He would remember them. He said, and I remember Brahmananda's mother, she came to the initiation of Brahmananda. And after I was initiated on the same evening, and he had her sitting up like in an honored position on a metal folding chair, the only chair in the room. So then after the initiation, Prabhupada said to Brahmananda, now bow down to your mother. And so she was sitting there awkwardly and uncomfortably, and Brahmananda made obeisances to his mother. He wanted to show this honor. And then she wasn't very friendly. Then she went in to talk with Swamiji. And he asked her, he knew that Brahmananda's father was wealthy. He owned a factory. He said, can you make a donation? And she became angry. She said, I've already given you two sons. That is enough. Said, all right, Prabhupada. So he was remembering this here in Vrindavan. And then, and I was there in Vrindavan. He said, and you, you would used to bring me a mango. So that was very, that touched me that he remembered that. It was such a small thing in his life, out of all the things he had done, opening temples and everything, and he said at the end of his life he would remember these little things. So the this mango giving was that Prabhupada used to talk about different things about India. And so he mentioned mangoes a number of times. One time he was telling us about his spiritual master. When he was a little child, he took a vow never to eat mangoes the rest of his life. In explaining this, Prabhupada said, you cannot appreciate what renunciation this is because you don't have mangoes in this country. But they are the king of fruits. So to be able to give up eating mangoes in India, this is very... So I thought, well, what is this mango? We don't really know what it is. And another time he said that there's no mangoes here. So I thought it would be nice if I could get him a mango. And at that time I was still apart, wasn't initiated, and I wasn't giving so much money. But every day, first I found out where to get a mango in a grocery store. They didn't keep mangoes out on the street in the boxes, but they had them in the freezer. They were a dollar each, which was a lot at that time. And so I would go every day, I get a mango and give it to him, like giving an apple to the teacher. So one day I went in and I gave the mango, and there was about half a dozen of his disciples were there, and Kirtananda, Umapati, Hayagriva. They were the ones, they were there all the time. And they didn't have any jobs or other engagements. So I gave him the mango. And Prabhupada said, "Very good boy." And they began to laugh. I took it that they were laughing at me because Prabhupada was like treating me like a little tiny boy. Like you would say to a Gurukul boy, "Very good boy." Whereas I was 26 years old. But when he saw that they were laughing, then he turned the mood, he became more serious. He said, "No, this is actually love. This is Krishna consciousness." So he accepted the mango as an offering and remembered it. There's really not enough time to talk about something that's a favorite of yours in one class, but that's all we have for this. I'd like to, before telling any more stories, make some application. So, for today, one outstanding feature of Prabhupada at this time is how he extended himself to others. That's his whole example in New York City. In the beginning, when he didn't have any followers, he extended himself to strangers to introduce them to Krishna consciousness uptown. And then, when some people in 26 Second Avenue actually wanted to become followers, he gave his time and himself to trying to train them up in Krishna consciousness. We can't imitate the level on which he did this, but we have to try to follow it. Our tendency is to live in our own little world with our own interests, but a compassionate devotee extends himself to others, spends time with them, sees them, and tries to give them this most precious thing. So we can do that either like Prabhupada did it in the beginning to strangers, when we preach to non-devotees by book distribution or by any kind of preaching like that, or as he did when he had followers, helping them. So in the remaining time, I'll try to tell some more stories. There was one incident when Prabhupada came back from San Francisco. Tomorrow we'll talk about San Francisco. And we'll talk about Prabhupada's return. So he came back in April of 1967. We had a big reception for him at the airport. And then life began as usual. We're so glad to have him back. I remember the morning after he returned, he'd been away. While he was away in just a few months, from January to March, he started the whole West Coast ISKCON and made so many affectionate relationships with devotees there. Now he was back with us. He liked the way there was some new things we had put in the temple room, a speaking lectern, and he said that this is Krishna consciousness, to always advance. And he gave so many wonderful examples in his lecturing. So then life began. Oh yeah, so the next morning, I remember, we were doing the kirtans without him. So now he was back, and he started singing like on this, we played the tape, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And then when our chorus came, at least my impression was that he was like shocked. And he looked out at everybody, because we sounded so dead, half dead, and croaking. This is what had happened to us in the interim while he was gone. We had lost our joyful spirit of chanting. We were still chanting, but it wasn't like it had been. But then everything became happy again, going up to see him, having our little business with him. I was the secretary of ISKCON, Brahmananda was the temple president. He asked us to make officers and to elect officers. And we were meeting to do that, and devotee came down. He said, Prabhupada wants you to elect officers, and he thinks Brahmananda should be the president, and Satsvarupa should be the secretary, and Gargamuni should be the treasurer. For a long time, I still had the invoices my job was to sign after Gargamuni would give the money for an item, then I had to approve it. So there were these little slips of paper that would say, like, a pair of socks, whatever it was. In other words, all the expenses of ISKCON came for whatever was collected, because we didn't have any money ourselves. One time when we were at talking at Harvard, not so long ago, this friendly professor, Professor Eck, she asked the question. She said, "You devotees who joined Prabhupada, my understanding is that you didn't have any more money than he did when he first came here, which was $8. So how did this movement become such a big movement?" And I had to laugh, because it was like that. As Prabhupada had nothing in his pocket, we didn't either.